The Guardian.
Hello everyone, Alex Hearn here. Just before we get going, I want to let you know that this Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you need a website and you're not sure where to start, build it with Squarespace. It's quick and easy to use. To start your free trial today, visit squarespace.com/guardian. Back in summer, remember that? The head of patients and information at the NHS, Tim Kelsey, announced their plans for a digital savvy health service that would save up to £10 billion by 2020. A big claim. But fast forward to the beginning of 2016, and Kelsey has moved on, leaving his grand ambitions for a faster, fitter, and more high-tech NHS behind him. So where does this leave the NHS's digital plans? This week, we have an NHS special on Tech Weekly as part of The Guardian's month-long project covering the National Health Service in all its many facets. We'll be taking the temperature of the NHS's digital health with Director of Technology for NHS England, Beverly Bryant, Dr. Mohamed Ali Baidley from Patients Know Best, and Stephen Hilton from UCL. Joining me from the tech desk is my compadre Dr. Samuel Gibbs, not that sort of doctor, who's been looking into this for our NHS season. I'm Alex Hearn, and this is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Three years ago, Jeremy Hunt announced his challenge for a paperless NHS by 2018. This meant, in practice, that more patients could access their online records, referrals could happen via email rather than letter, and records could follow patients across any part of the NHS or social care system without getting lost between the cracks. Now we have the pledge from NHS England to be paperless at point of care by 2020. But what are some of the implications of putting such an enormous quantity of confidential patient information online? First of all, Sam, you've been writing on this for the NHS project. Can you sketch out the landscape for us on this? How has the scheme progressed and what are some of the pitfalls it's faced?
So right now you may assume when you head into a hospital that that everything you've ever done in the NHS or have been treated by, seen a doctor, had any sort of care, is at the fingertips of the doctors that are hoping to put you right now. That is the case in some places, but not always, and not as quite as reliably as you might assume as a patient on the outside. And basically, the paperless at patient care by 2020 is aiming to put that right, and it's a good thing. That is definitely something that we should be going for. The one thing that you might know is that the summary care record, the thing that your GPs hold, the GPs are the holder of your data as a person in the NHS, I suppose. The summary care record was one of the first things to be pushed forward into the digital era, and that seemingly works well enough that if you go into your GP does hopefully remember you. Now, hopefully, that will extend to the rest of the NHS. I mean, the problem is that we've seen the NHS go through several attempts to reform and move forward, especially on the IT front, and there have been problems. Understandable, it is a very, very complex organisation.
And Beverly Bryant, NHS Director of Digital Technology, what sort of benefits will patients get when this scheme is finished, other than, I guess, having to speak to their doctors less?
Well, the main job here is to allow a faster and improved diagnosis, improved safety, for example, electronic prescribing, because the NHS organisations are joined up between diagnostic testing, outpatients, discharges, social care, etc. Being able to get quickly access to all the information about a patient, that's the driver.
I mean, some people listening will be obviously thinking, how hard can it be if it's already there for GPs? It's just computers. What sort of hurdles do you have to cross to do this sort of thing?
Well, we've tried to do this in the past and we have not done a great job, to be honest. Our attempts have varied in the early 2000s where we just threw money at it and there wasn't necessarily the expertise in the NHS to deliver it. Then we did the National Programme for IT. And the problem there was that we effectively imposed a technical solution on the NHS. And the clinicians and doctors and nurses didn't have ownership of those solutions.
So in other words, doctors and nurses arrived at work one day with a computer system that they were told to use and hated it.
We had a mixed response. Some picked it up, some didn't. But broadly, we didn't really get the clinical buy-in to the whole process that is fundamental to making this a success. So we've changed our approach.
So what is different this time?
So the approach this time is to say, we won't tell you what to buy. We won't tell you how to operate. We have a federated system, local organisations. But we will help you. We will use money. We've been successful in getting a spending review settlement to start putting some investment in this. And we'll also start to define standards that you have to adhere to electronically. So we'll set, through our commissioning and regulatory levers, conditions that hospitals and organisations have to meet for a digital future for their patients, but we won't tell them exactly how to do it. That'll be up to them to decide for themselves.
Dr. Ali Bidley, you're the founder of Patients Know Best. Does this sound hopeful to you? Do you think that this could be the time the NHS cracks the nut?
This should have been done earlier. It's the benefit of everyone in the system if we go digital. If you imagine any other sector not being digital, it will be far less efficient, far less effective. The problem for the health service, not the NHS, but health service in general, is medical data is far more complicated than any other domain of expertise. So the computer systems, the IT systems, have not been ready in the past. And to build the right computer systems, you have to have the users buying in, building it with the programmers. And that hadn't happened in the past as well. So Beverly's describing the problems the UK had, but it's not like any other country cracked it either. Everybody's been struggling. And the UK was the first in the world to have GPs with electronic record back in, you mentioned the 90s, the first one's 1975. First GP surgery in the world. So it's a struggle. The UK is going through it, but it's not an easy problem to solve.
Now, for the most part, we've been talking about information sharing within hospitals and between various care providers. Dr. Alibaidi, you also think that an increasing amount of that data should be shared with patients themselves. Why is that?
First of all, it's just the right thing to do. It's my body, so it's my data. I ought to know what's happening. You ought to tell me, as a person with a long-term condition myself, I want to know what you're doing to me. But also, the healthcare system needs me to know, because 70% of healthcare spending is on people with long-term conditions. They've had an illness for a year or more, diabetes, asthma, heart conditions. If the person with the illness doesn't understand or agree with what's being done, much of that money is wasted. We're talking about the doctor or the GP or the hospital doing something to the patient. Maybe that's true for 1 hour in the year. The other 8,000 hours, the patient is doing things to the patient. They're the ones taking the pills. They're the ones changing their exercise. They're the ones changing their diet. So if they don't understand and carry out things correctly as a provider of care themselves, then much of that money is wasted. And they can't understand unless you give them the data. So they're a key stakeholder to know everything that's happened to the patient.
It's easy to say share the data with the patient, but if you handed me the 80 pages of medical records that came out of an appendectomy, I wouldn't have much to do with that. I'd thank you and then carefully recycle them, hopefully after shredding them. I mean, when in practical terms, what can people do with this data other than stare at it and turn back to the doctor for help interpreting it? Okay.
I would like to remind you we're going for a paperless NHS, so we'll give you a digital version before you recycle
it. Securely digitally erase it then.
But the when you have structured digital information, then we have tons of digital tools that make that intelligible to a patient. If you say a medical term to a patient 20 years ago, they would not have understood it. Today, they'll know within a couple of seconds from a Google search, a Wikipedia search, exactly what that term means. After a few minutes, they'll learn more about their condition. After a few days, because they're stuck with that condition, they will start become experts in their own disease. If you look at rare diseases, the patients know more than most doctors do about their illness. And finally, even if you're not interested or not able reading those pieces of paper, somebody in your family loves you, is interested. They're very often very motivated. They just never had the chance to look at the information with your permission. There's no other scalable way of solving our healthcare problems for the next century if it's only the professionals who are doing things. Even if we had the money, which we don't have enough professionals. It has to be the lay people, the patients, their carers, who are taking ownership and taking care of themselves.
Beverly, is this sort of information sharing even on the NHS's roadmap right now?
It is. We think that giving patients access to their records could really help people with long-term conditions. That's the area that we're focusing in on. We don't see that the patients having their record and trailing that around the system is the answer. I think we owe it to our citizens of England to know everything about you across the system. I think wearable devices and detailed patient records can really change the relationship between the GP and the patient.
Words like open and data sharing are words that people might feel comfortable hearing next to words like private medical information. How do you square those circles? How do you keep the information secure while sharing it with the people who need it? And how do you convince patients that random people won't see confidential medical information?
So the information that we're going to architect and design to transfer across care settings will always be done in a secure way. We have a secure network, we have a secure email service, and the standards that we expect our software to meet is rigorous in that regard.
Sam, you've looked into the security of these systems. Is that something that you think can be done?
It's going to be a challenge. One of the things I think it has going for it is not having data all in one massive lump is a good thing. And as I understand it, that's the goal. It's not going to be one massive database. But one thing I'm interested to learn about is how the computing standard of the NHS is going to deal with this. I mean, it's a notoriously backward system. You often have many, many computers that almost outlive anything else. I mean, how are we going to bring up the computing standards to meet the requirements to be able to facilitate this seamless digital transition?
So the computing standards are set. They're industry-wide. They're agreed. The difficulty is ensuring adherence to them in a distributed system where we reduce the risk because we've got locally held data. We just have to make sure everybody reaches a level of adherence around those technical and safety standards. And that's, again, where the commissioning and regulatory levers come in to say, you know, we're going to fund technology now through the next 5 years, but in return you need to adhere to a standard.
So we've heard how the NHS doesn't have the greatest track record when it comes to adopting new technology. And admirable though it is, getting hospitals connected to Wi-Fi and patient records online doesn't sound particularly cutting edge to the rest of the tech world. But one technology which could have vast potential for the future of healthcare, as Beverly said, is wearables. These devices could make it easier for health professionals to get reliable data on medical conditions like diabetes or asthma. NHS Medical Director Sir Bruce Keogh joined our sister pod Science Weekly yesterday and is clear on how important wearables could become for the health service.
In my mind, I can see a time where someone who's prone to having to go in and out of hospital with heart failure is sitting at home and wearing some sort of device, and they get a phone call. An expert says to them, Mr. Jones, it looks as though you're starting to go into the early phases of heart failure again. We're sending someone around to monitor you or give you an intravenous injection of diuretic or something like that. That is going to change things dramatically.
Beverly, you hold hope for wearable devices being integrated into the NHS. How do you see it helping? What sort of devices are we talking about? Are we talking about these general consumer wellness monitors or far more specific clinical devices?
We're not at this stage looking at sort of general wellness kind of monitors. We don't think that's our priority. But rather, wearables that integrate with the record, I think in America they have gone mad on standalone wearable devices that don't actually, they're not tethered or integrated to the record that's held clinically. So I think the two-way interaction between uploading blood pressures, blood monitor, etc., as part of a care plan is something that we're looking at. But I want to move at a reasonably slow pace with this. I think we need to bring the clinical community with us, and we need to test the validity and the clinical efficacy of it. But in the studies we've already done, patients in particular are saying that it's so much more convenient for them to not have to be going in on three buses to get to a rural GP surgery to have a test when they could actually do it on a device that automatically uploads.
And Dr. Alabidley, you hold hope for this as well?
Yes, so one of the things we do in Patients Know Best is all these devices that you get off the shelf, which are marketed as wellness devices for because of the legal team, basically. They yes. don't want the litigation aspects of being a formal medical device. It's a consumer device they start. But actually, there's lots of useful, usable data that you can plug into the medical record. So it flows from the patient's home into Patients Know Best, into the doctor's record. If I just give you two examples of where that's clinically useful, that was a surprise to me to hear about. So if you've got a Fitbit that can track your sleep, if you compare that to, at the moment, someone with heart failure, where you come in every few months and the doctor asks, how is your sleep? Because whether you're getting up at night to go to the toilet affects their interpretation of how well the pills are working. So if your Fitbit can actually show you over 6 months, you're waking up this many times every night, it's a much better conversation than it was all right, doctor, or not so well, doctor. If you look at water consumption, so I saw this water device that tracks how much you drink. Initially, when I saw it, I thought, this is for Californians obsessed about how much to drink, getting their 8 liters. But actually, if you're on chemotherapy, you have to drink lots of water, but often you're too frail and you forget to drink the water. If you're on dialysis machine, you mustn't drink more than a liter of water. So the colors on the device tell you when you're drinking as much as they want you to, or drinking more than they want you to. So all of that is, if you bring it back into the clinical pathway, very powerful. And these devices are not only cheap enough to give to lots of people, but they are consumer friendly. People use them as opposed to traditional medical devices.
But the other thing that traditional medical devices have that's different from these consumer ones is a much more rigorous quality testing. I mean, when it comes to an Apple Watch or a Fitbit, they're often a bit flaky in terms of whether they even recognize that you're asleep or just watching telly. Is that good enough for a clinical setting, or are we talking about the sort of data where scratch information is good enough?
It's a spectrum. So if you look at something like blood pressure, you wouldn't prescribe based on your home blood pressure monitor that's £100. But if you want to monitor blood pressure over a few months and avoid white coat hypertension, where just being measured by your doctor scares you and brings up your blood pressure, if you then look at that trend is very useful. And then when it comes time to prescribing, you will come to your doctor and they will do a formal blood pressure measurement before going back.
Beverly, is offloading some of these measurements onto patients, is that a good thing? I mean, obviously, it sounds like it will save money, but are we going to get worse quality measurements, or are we going to have much happier patients?
I think at the moment that there is quite a lot of variability in the technology across some of these advertised as the same or similar wearable devices, and so we don't, you know, as the NHS, we don't want to just leave it to chance about what's accurate or not. We want to test them rigorously. So we're going to introduce apps like, not accreditation, like kite marking. So there'll be a number of these wearables or apps that we have said we trialled them, and we'll put them on our NHS.UK. Sort of apps library to say if CCGs or GPs want to prescribe these to or recommend them to their patients, they've been through a test and compared to others, they are, you know, if you like, they've got the NHS badge associated with them. So that's something we'll be doing over the next couple of years, because as a national body, it's important that we don't just leave these things to chance.
At the consumer end, one criticism of all of this category has been that people measure everything and learn nothing. Is there a risk that the same will happen when that data is fed into the NHS, that you'll have an overwhelming amount of information on patients and actually it'll just increase data storage costs and make it harder to store?
Yeah, we need to control it. There's no, the last thing we need is to be bombarding our GPs with information that they just is like a tsunami. It needs to be controlled. They need to decide in conjunction with the patient who might be, you know, best use some of these technologies as part of a care plan and an ongoing dialogue. And it's, if it's useful for the patient and the GP, then I really believe it'll hit off.
After the break, we'll be hearing from Steve Hilton on how the future of pharmacies will be 3D printed. That's after this.
If you run a mobile business, you need a payment solution that's simple, safe, and seamless. With Braintree, you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards, and more across any platform. With superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts, it's the full-stack payment solution for your business. To learn more and for your first £30,000 of transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/techweekly.
If digital records and wearable health devices are already fixed in the sights of the NHS, what's the technology on the horizon that can help save the health service? You've heard of designer babies, but we could have designer pills, medicine that can use 3D printing technology to tailor drugs to your individual needs, be that your size, your weight, or even if you're into that sort of thing, to look like Peppa Pig or superhero characters. Sam, the Peppa Pig ones can be for you, I'll keep the superheroes. The possibilities for this could be massive, giving pharmacists the ability to tailor and print out customised drugs within the decade. One of the people involved in this research is Dr. Stephen Hilton of the UCL School of Pharmacy. Dr. Hilton, explain how this works for the layman.
Well, 3D printing is a new technology. You can see things, you can make things. Whatever you can imagine, ultimately you can make. And that's the idea behind it. So any shape, any size, Peppa Pig, Superman, all these things are possible, really.
So, I mean, printing a tablet in the shape of a Superman S firstly sounds a bit like something you'd find in a club late on a Friday night. But also, you know, you can see how it's useful for getting kids to take pills, but hardly the sort of revolutionary technology that will transform the health service. What sort of things can they do that take it a bit further?
I think 3D printing is not just about printing pills. It's the technology as a whole. So you can print out models of disease as well. So helping doctors understand things, saving money, doing things in a better way, less wastage. All these things are possible. But for tablets, say my weight is slightly greater after Christmas, you could then monitor that and work out the dose that's required to match that patient.
So, Stephen, our listeners will be intimately acquainted with 3D printing because we've been talking about it probably for the last 10 years, something like that. The hype cycle has been gone and we now actually have products. But when you buy a home 3D printer, you buy the filament, you stick it in, and it's basically like a glorified glue gun laying down layers. How does it work for a drug?
For a drug, it's basically the same. So when you look at the colours that are coming out of the printer, they are an organic molecule. They're a compound. They're potentially a drug. So different colours could be potential drugs. As you're printing a colour, it can be a drug, your dose, your size, your shape of a drug or medicine that you want.
I mean, when you or I take a pill from off the shelf, typically it will have some sort of mixing agent or a shell or a coat to target it to the area in the body that it's required. Not everything needs to be dissolved in the stomach. Some drugs need to go further. How does that happen in a 3D printing scenario?
Part of it is different coatings. Somehow you have single head printers or double head printers. So you can build your own shells around the drug that you want to actually incorporate into the tablet. That then dissolves in the stomach, leaving the drug to be released later in the system.
So in terms of the pharmacies that would be incorporating this tech, is this something which to most people will just be a big grey box at the back of the boots where they go and pick up their medication? Or is it something that will be much more integrated into their experience with the healthcare system?
I think at the start, it probably will be a big grey box at the back. The control is there for the NHS. They want to maintain the standards, the right dosing for the patient. But longer term, we could see it in patients' homes, monitoring how they're actually tolerating the medicine, how well they're absorbing it, their pharmacokinetics behind it. And ultimately, then you print out the next dose based around how much drug is already in their system.
When it comes to 3D printing outside of healthcare, one of the flashpoints for it has been intellectual property. People have tried to print off figurines for games and been sued by games companies. They've tried to print off Mickey Mouse, all sorts, and been sued by Disney. Are there the same issues in the healthcare system? Can I just go and print off a patented drug?
You can't really print off a patented drug because you have to buy the precursors to make those, and that's not possible. Now, the designs will be patented, so that's where the challenge comes. But new designs are always outside of patent space, so ultimately you could design a tablet with a different character on it, which would be outside of patent space.
Mohammed, this interacts quite strongly with your area. Access to patient records can presumably help the pharmacies which would be tailoring 3D printed drugs to tailor them all the better. Is that the dream, or is that something which is very practically on the cusp of happening?
We already have examples of this happening in everyday medicine, especially if you take into account the genetic sequence of the patient. So not just the size and the situation, but their genetic properties. So antibiotics that are very powerful, but don't get used enough because a small number of the population would go deaf if they had the particular gene. So if you can test for that gene in advance before you give the pill to the patient, you can decide actually this patient won't be affected by it, so go ahead and give them the benefits, or actually this one will be at risk, don't give them the medication. If you look at cancer, chemotherapy, each of the drugs works depending on the mutation that's in that particular cancer. If you could sequence that, check it in advance, figure out which ones will get the benefits, great, give it to them, and which ones won't, so save them from all the side effects that come from chemotherapy. That personalization is very powerful.
Stephen, I mean, the end stage, the science fiction future that you're suggesting for us is that ill, you know, severely ill patients, maybe even just slightly ill patients, would have a 3D printer in their home churning out wonderfully personalized medicines which vary the dosage as their weight fluctuates every morning. How long until we see this, or, you know, the basic steps towards it coming to market?
I think we're already starting to see that. The printing market has changed enormously. Printers are coming down in price enormously. And again, tying towards pharmacies, you've seen technology, the wearable technology has been a 4 or 5 year revolution. And that's really come in place now. And it's starting to be everywhere you see it, it's here. 3D printing, I think, is about 5 years behind that. And we are starting to head towards that with medicines now. You've seen the first one come to the market already.
Is this a new frontier for the pharmaceutical industry to innovate, or is this something that's happening outside of the industry? I mean, you work at UCL, you're not working for GlaxoSmithKline, but are they as excited about this technology as you are?
I think excited, also scared as well. There's lots of potential, but lots of challenges as well. So you've seen a lot of small companies starting up, as we've done ourselves at UCL, to try and bring this forward. And really, that's like a open market for ourselves in that respect.
Thank you very much. So that's all we have time for today. Thanks to all my guests, Beverly Bryant, Dr. Mohamed Alubaidli, Dr. Stephen Hilton, and, as ever, Samuel Gibbs. Our producer this week has been Alana Chance. For more info on our NHS coverage, head to the Guardian website, where there's all manner of articles, from the personal to the political. The audio team has also been making a series of themed NHS podcasts this week, if you fancy a binge listen. Natalie will be back next week. We'll see you then.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.